meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Are there any other alcoholics present? Would you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of today's meeting is the leader qualifies for 5 minutes, followed by the main speaker. I guess I'll have to say a few words, right? It may take a little more than 5 minutes. I don't know. Today, my name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sorry. And today's a good day for me. I didn't have to drink or drug. Very good day. Probably one of the best days of my life. This is a great honor to be up here. It really is. I don't know, I came to this program about 3.5 years ago. I come from a dysfunctional family of a little gambling, a little drugs, a little just dysfunctionality. You know, when you come into the program, you learn about dysfunctionality, you say, my family, not my family. And then after a while, you realize, you know, what dysfunctionality really is, you know. I don't know, like I said, I came to program, I'm sober a little, 42 or 43 months. When I really, I tried when I was real young to get sober, and I couldn't do it when I was about 15 or 16. A brother of mine was in a therapeutic community. They forced me to go. I went. After about 6 months, I took off, and boom, I went out of whack. Started dealing coke again, started drinking heavy. Hanging out with the big boys after hours. I thought I was a real, real cuisine, tough guy. Sometimes I think I still am. And it was great. I was getting free drugs, free liquor, free whatever I wanted. I was like 16 years old. I'd come home at 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd have a three-piece suit on. I'd go into the barber and ask him to trim my mustache. I had no hair on my face. It was funny. It was real funny. When I was about 19, I was introduced to AA by this guy Tommy, I know, from my home group, Tommy the Roof. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't know about AA. And he took me to my first meeting, and I said, what the hell am I doing? Look at all these old people and stuff like that. I said, and there was a sign, they said, sobriety can be fun. I said, these people are crazy. How could you have fun without getting drunk, you know? And today I could have a ball without getting drunk, you know? After that, I stopped. I didn't go to any more meetings. I started dating this girl that I dated when I was about 12. I was about 19. We started going out with each other, and we moved in together. And I was drinking real heavy, getting high on drugs. And she didn't care that I got high on drugs as long as I didn't drink, because I would get violent when I would drink, and I would hit her and wreck the house and havoc I would cause, jails and whole bunch of craziness, bust up the house. They would have to hold me down so I wouldn't go out. I put my parents through hell, my family through hell. She left me after about 3 years. After about 3 years and about 4 beatings I gave her, and about getting locked up 3 times, and she stood by me. I can't say she didn't for a while, but I guess she took too much and she left. And when she left, they opened up an AA meeting right across the street from my house, and I was there about a year. And I used to go in the little candy store across the street from my house, and I see this woman, this lady Karen, from I used to see in the clubhouse before they moved to where I lived. And I'd be drinking a beer, and I'd tell her, I know where you're going. I says, I'm doing fine, I would tell her, you know. I'd be sticking three down my sleeve and drinking one in the back, you know, and buying a piece of candy. After, like I said, she left, and I started going to meetings, and I would sit in the back, and I'd raise my hand, and I'd say, hi, my name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I haven't drank for 7 days. And everybody would go, yay, you know. But when I left the meeting, I'd get on my bike. I'd go to Bath Avenue on Bay 20th Street, and I'd buy a dime bag of pot. I thought that was all right, you know. I'd go to the dentist, I'd get a tooth pull, I'd get some painkillers, and, you know, they said one every 3 hours. I take nine every 3 hours, you know. And I thought that was, you know, all right. I'm not drinking, you know, that's all right, you know. And after about three weeks, I ran into a man today who I love dearly as my sponsor. And it was a Sunday night. It was July 9th of 1989. And he says, you got a sponsor? I said, it was a feelings meeting. It was a 7 o'clock feelings meeting. And I was out of it. I was hysterical, crying. I said, this girl left me. I don't know what to do. I can't drink no more. I can't do this no more. I got no job. I had to give up the apartment. I'm back with my parents. My life is in shambles. And after the meeting, the coffee break, we started talking. He says, you got a sponsor? I said, no. He goes, are you going to get one? I said, I don't know who to ask. One thing led to another. I asked him. And that night we took a ride over to this pizza shop where near my house, Smolny Gardens. And we went in and we were having some pizza. And he said, I can't help you if you're going to continue to smoke any pot. I said, all right, I wanted some help. He goes, the only reason you're feeling this pain is because you continue to getting high. I says, I don't want to feel this no more. I went home, I had a half a joint, I remember, I smoked it, and that was it. Monday morning, July 10th, the grace of God, I'm still sober. I got a call that afternoon. It was my ex-girlfriend. She says to my sister Kathy, tell Chris I'm sorry about last night. That guy was in Smolny Gardens, but was only a friend. I didn't even see her. You know, I didn't even see her. You know, she was in the place, you know, and I've been sober ever since then. It's been real hard, man. It's been real hard. The last year and a half has been real tough, Paul. I've been out of work. I've been on compensation. I hurt my leg, you know, and I don't know, just life is getting to me, you know. It's real hard, you know. Whether you're an alcoholic or whether you're not, you know, life is difficult. It really is, you know. It's like I'm at a stage, like, I'm sober 3.5 years, and I feel like I'm going nowhere, you know. I feel like I'm not going up and I'm not going down, you know. I got to start working on myself, and it's hard, you know. It's so hard to change the things that you're so comfortable with. And when you're doing good, and I ain't used to having good things and doing good in my life. So it like feels, you know, it feels uneasy. You know, you think that a new job or a girl or walking around with $500 in your pocket or doing this or doing that is going to make you feel good and feel better. It's not the way it is. It's within you. You know what I'm saying? And some days, you know, I have a feeling where I could carry the world on my shoulders. I really do. I feel great, you know, and that's due to this program, you know. I made a promise to a friend of mine yesterday. He says, I want you to start working 1 through 5, you know, because I go to meetings and all I do really is I don't drink and I go to meetings. I do very little work on myself, you know, all right, for the first year, maybe the first year and a half, 2 years, all right, you know, I'm in my fourth year, I think, you know, some things got to be changed in my life, you know. I don't know, my parents, I love dearly, they stick by me, real good, you know. They know how to push my buttons. They really do, especially my father. And being away from me, you know, I'm 26 years old, but it's very hard. I'm like, I never done these things. I never been away from home. I never went away. So it's like all new to me. Growing up, I was in Sonora Bay about 9 months ago, and it was real, real hard for me, real hard. I wanted to leave by Wednesday. You know, I got here Saturday. The plane flight got a little messed up, and I was real mad. We got here like five hours late, and I was pissed off at the guys who booked the flight, and I'm pissed off at everybody. But you hold the resentment, and who does it hurt? It hurts you. It don't hurt nobody else. They were here, you know, everybody was here already. Saturday night, I went into my room, and I went to sleep about 2 o'clock, and about 2:30, I got up, and my heart was racing. I was hyperventilating. I opened the door to my room. I started walking in the hallway. I said, the hell with this. I ain't staying here. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm out of here. I'm getting a taxi. I'm going to the airport. I'm getting an airplane back to the States. You know, it's like I feel like trapped in, you know, and that's like more issues of when I was younger, you know. I don't know, it's like I was going to therapy for a little while and I stopped because I was getting in touch with too many feelings and I couldn't handle it. You know, when I first got sober, I was going back to school because I'm not very well educated. I was going back to school. I was working a job on the books for the first time in my life. And I was going to meetings, trying to make 90 meetings in 90 days. I had all this stuff on my hands. So I stopped going to school and I continued to work because I needed money. I needed to keep my sanity. And I continued to go to meetings because I didn't want to drink and drug no more and live a miserable life. You know, as much as I go through today, I don't pick up a drink. As much as I want to, I don't pick up a drink. You know, I wanted to go in back at a bar and bust open the counter and have a few drinks the other night. I figured that would have put me to sleep and relieved my anxiety. But what would it have done to me the next day? You know, I don't know. Like I said, this is an honor to be here. My life is better than it ever was, you know, and I thank my parents for bringing me into this world, and I thank God, my higher power, for bringing me here tonight. I would never change my life or anything that's happened in my life. Maybe one thing. If I could have my ex-girlfriend back, I would have her back, you know. It's hard for me. When you hold on to something for a long time, it's very difficult. You know, she's married today. She got married about 8 months ago, and that was real hard for me to deal with, you know. And that's about the only thing if I could change, I would change. All the locked up times, all the drinking and drugging, I wouldn't change because I wouldn't be where I am today. And where I am today, I have friends in my life that are beautiful that I never had before, you know. And it's a good day for me, you know. One friend I'm going to bring up right now to read the traditions. I'm going to bring Pat S. up to read the traditions. The next person that's going to come up, I met him about 9 months ago. We're in Sonora Bay. I remember another friend of mine bumped into him, and he was saying to him, he goes, you look familiar. Did you ever play any ball, you know? And he goes, you know, it was funny because he was excellent, and he is an ex-football player. But what made me take such a liking to him and everything is when he got up and he spoke on some family issues that really touched me, about his mom and about his dad and about his brothers and his sisters, and it really touched my heart and got it deep inside me, and he just hit a good nerve, you know. And when I got home, I was showing my brother a bunch of pictures. My brother's 32 years old, and he's a heroin addict. I was showing my brother a bunch of pictures. I try to tell my brother, like, look at these people that are doing good, and maybe he would, you know, listen, but he don't, you know. That's, I guess, life. And I went home, and I was like, I was with Tom Sands, you know. As he spoke, he sounded great, and everything. I was telling my friend Pat and everybody else, and I guess there's no other words to bring up this guy. Welcome Thomas Henderson.
My name is Thomas Henderson, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Chris. Chris should be in the movies. What a voice, huh? He could do gangster films or something. Hey, what do you mean, man? Come here, man, you know. I'm glad to be here. I'm actually glad to be anywhere, and I'm wearing white tonight because I'm pure. Today I'm one of the most grateful recovering alcoholics that I know. You see, in 1983, I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in trouble, with no future, with no friends, with no career, no money, nowhere to stay. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nowhere else to go. And since 1983, I can stand up here and tell you here in Ixtapa, Mexico, I still have nowhere else to go. I found my tribe. Early in my recovery, I was lucky enough to meet a man named Chuck D, who had a sponsor named Frank O, who had a sponsor named Chuck C. And I have found out through this program, I'm emotional tonight because I'm real grateful. I have found out through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that sponsors and friends are holy. I had a chance to talk to Chuck C, you know, and right at the end of his life. And I'm just lucky to have met the right people at the right time in order for me to get a great foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure, I go to other fellowships. I'm sick, you know, I'm afraid to watch Oprah, you know. Hell, they might have something new, you know. Shit, I say, hell, I got that too, you know. Two things are apparent to me right now. And that is, early on in this program, a couple of things are real clear to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Chris kind of touched on it here a few minutes ago. There is a part of this fellowship that says, I can just don't drink and go to meetings. And then the other part of this fellowship is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the attractions was, as people said, in the big book it said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, here are the steps you take to get it. Well, I've taken those steps. And I'd like to hope that I'm where the big book talks about around step 10, where I do have something. Because instead of me hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous all my damn life, wanting what somebody across the room has, at some point in this program, I gotta like what I got. And today, I like what I got from this fellowship. I don't have to look across the room and wish that I had what you had. You know, particularly with women, you know. So I like what I got from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like to nurture that, and I like to be green and growing rather than ripe and rotten, and I like to pass on stuff that I think is useful to other human beings. You know, I've been through a lot of therapy and a lot of treatment and counseling, and I even did some time in the penitentiary, and everything that's happened to me has been a blessing. I'm one of the few people I know in the state of California, they rescued me from me. I spent 2 years and 4 months in the penitentiary, and it was the best 2 years and 4 months that I can remember because I planned to have a life. I'm supposed to tell you tonight what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. Well, what it was like is I was born and raised in a dysfunctional home, which most of us, you know, say that when we come here. But I always like to tell people, let me describe my family to you. My mother, Violet Faye, God bless her. Violet Faye was a 15-year-old girl who had a bouncing, bubbling boy named Thomas in March of 1953. And she had gotten pregnant on a one little relationship with a guy who was in the military, and of course he was a young man, and I was born in 1953, this 15-year-old girl, and I kind of grew up with her. But my mother was a violent woman, and part of me was violent until I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't do that anymore. When I was 12 years old, my mom and stepfather fought a lot. Now, I didn't meet my real father until I was 21 years old and playing in the National Football League. All of a sudden, he came out of the woodwork in New York. Hey, that's my boy there. That's my son. Boy, what a kid. Ain't he a good-looking boy? We'll talk about him later. My mother and father fought on weekends. You know, they would go to the grocery store, and one of the stores they stopped by on every Friday night was a liquor store, and they would come out with the brown paper sack, you know, with the bag kind of twisted tight, you know, and that was their bottle. And that bottle caused a lot of problems in my household. So I was the oldest child of five, and I was the only one in the house named Henderson. The rest of them was named Rivers, you know. And so right off, as a young child, I intuitively knew there was something wrong with this house, because my little brothers and sisters knew who their father was, and I did not, see? So I felt a little less than early on, you know, a little, where's my daddy, mama? Well, he's in New York. Well, what does he look like? Go look in the mirror. Well, why don't he come down here? I don't know. So it was an unanswered question for many years, but they fought. I mean, my mother, you know, I used to hear when Caucasian people fight, it was a verbal thing. When black people fight, it's like black eyes and noses busted and shootings. And so when I was 12 years old one night, I had witnessed a lot of these fights and been part of some of them. I walked out on the porch one night, and my mother was standing there with her eyes both black and bloodied. My stepfather was staggering in the yard drunk, and she had his rifle that she had just bought him for Christmas, cocked, loaded, and aimed at him. And she said to him, and I thought was pretty good information, she said, "Don't you come near this house, and you better leave here now, or I'm going to shoot you." Well, being the good alcoholic, brave alcoholic that he was, he took another step, and she shot him. And I got to tell you, the 12-year-old kid standing against the paneling of that front porch there, when I saw the flame jump out of the rifle, the sound of that, my father making a sound, and the smell of the gun smoke, one thing happened to me at 12 years old. She scared me to death. And I never understood their relationship, because he went to the hospital. I was 12 years old. I don't remember y'all remember this back in the old days. They wouldn't let you on emergency floors or up into the hospital unless you were 12. Now, I remember being 12 because I was the only child who could go up and see my stepfather. And he had tubes running down his nose, had tubes running in his body a couple of places, and you know, and he survived this gunshot. But one thing I learned from that experience, you know, you always learn something. There's always a silver lining in something. I learned that if a woman ever shoots me, I'm moving. Because he moved back into the house with her, and they were together another 15 years. Well, see, that's a dysfunctional house. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 18, it talks about the employer, the wives, but one statement in there, it talks about the warped lives of blameless children who are raised in alcoholic and dysfunctional homes. See, I was one of those children, and I think I have the right to deal with those issues. And I've done that in my recovery. Well, of course, and it took my mother opened up an after-hours joint. Of course, she became famous with the gun by then. It went from Violet Faye to Annie Oakley. She shot several men at the after-hour club that we had in Austin. And in 1978, while I was playing in the National Football League, I was called off the field by Tom Landry one day, and he said, "I got a message here," and I asked him to go re-verify it. He says, "But here's the message. They say your mother shot your grandfather 5 times. Call home." So if anybody in this room don't understand that a 12-year-old boy comprehended one thing, my first feeling that I understood and comprehended was fear. Pure, blatant fear. Shame-based. Didn't know what my father was. I remember as a child going to the grocery store with my family, and we were every Friday. My daddy got paid 70, 80 bucks. I remember kind of what that money was, $65 or something. It was 1965 in there. And we would go to the grocery store, and, you know, me and my four children, my four siblings, my four brothers and sisters, we would, like, terrorize the store. In other words, when I left the grocery store on Friday night, I was full. Trust me. But I remember going to the parking lot with my family, and we were loading groceries into our raggedy car, and something struck me, you know, that I really always wanted to go with the family over there. I wish I could go home with them. See, because as far as I can remember, as long as I can remember, until I was 13 years old, my mother beat the hell out of me. She wouldn't let my stepfather hit me. And I resent that. She made a statement about a year ago in front of mixed company. She said, "You know, I beat him the most, and he turned out the best." I resented that. She thought it was a compliment. I finally got out of this house at 16 years old. I decided to leave and move to Oklahoma to live with my grandmother, who was a Bible-thumping woman. I got out of Austin, and I moved to Oklahoma and went back to high school. My drinking and drugging career, you know, I think if you're raised by alcoholics, they give you alcohol early on. So, you know, somebody said, "Where was your first drink?" Well, it was probably on a bottle. I don't remember, you know, sucking on a bottle and go, "Hey, this is a good bud," but I'm just saying, I think if you're raised by alcoholics, they give you alcohol. So we don't know when we had our first drink. I kind of resented alcohol. I actually swore it off for many, many, many years. I said I would never drink and be like them. I'm never going to drink like them. I hated the smell of it. I hated the way it came out of their skin. I just didn't like the stuff. So I was a young man who liked to do fun felonies. I liked to steal and sell. I was a street boy. My mother and father had nothing. They worked hard. They were hardworking people. So I finally got out of high school in 1971 and went to college in Oklahoma at a little small school, 900 students. And, you know, nobody had recruited me as the greatest football player in the world. I was actually, nobody knew who the hell I was by the time I got to Langston University in Oklahoma. And I put on a uniform and became Violet Faye for 4 years. We lost my senior year at Langston University. We lost all but one football game, and the University of Oklahoma won the national championship, and I was the first player drafted out of Oklahoma in the first round by the Dallas Cowboys. through college, I smoked marijuana, took acid, mescaline, just whatever you had. You know, it just didn't matter what you had, except I didn't drink. I'd buy you a drink. I'd go in on a bottle of wine, but I didn't drink. I don't like alcohol. It was way later on that I loved that green bottle with the little red rose on it. Are there any Tangerine tonic drinkers here? Oh. You know, the reason I couldn't get sober the first time because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I got to tell this story intermittently. I was the first NFL player to go public with my cocaine addiction in 1981. Of course, I called the commissioner. So I'm a grandiose guy. I could have called Tom Landry. I could have called the press or mom and dad, you know. But I called the NFL commissioner's office, and the secretary, I remember that day, she said, the commissioner's busy in meetings all day. I said, well, give him this message for me. Tell him this is Thomas Hollywood Henderson, and I'm smoking cocaine, and I really need to speak with him. I mean, if you want to get through, you got to give him reason to call you back. So he reached out and touched my ass in about 2 minutes. And I went into a drug treatment program, and I'm skipping around here, but I wanted to put this in. I went into treatment in 1981. Now, you know, I've been sober since 83, so I went in 81, went into a psychiatric hospital, and of course, that's why I like step two in this program, because I was one insane man when I got here. I was angry. I was lonely. I was a mess when I got into this program. So I got there, and the funny thing about the alcoholic or anybody who comes into these rooms initially or whatever, we seem to have a hidden agenda, because most of the time I think we can pinpoint what the problem is. I had pinpointed my problem was cocaine. So I didn't listen to anything about alcohol or anything about marijuana or anything about pills during my 60-day, $53,000 treatment experience. They celebrated when I left. They clapped me out, put a circle around me, loved me, empowered me, energized me. And I got in my Mercedes-Benz, and a friend of mine picked me up, and we were headed back to Dallas. I was going to drive because it was beautiful to be getting out of treatment. They gave me a beautiful medallion. It was beautiful, and we were riding down the highway doing about 70 miles an hour, 1981, about March, close to my birthday, and my friend had bought me a bag of marijuana, and I rolled me a big fat joint of marijuana. As we're cruising down the highway, I rolled a joint, pushed in the lighter, fired it up, and said to my buddy doing about 70, I said, yeah, I think this program's going to work. This is going to be beautiful. And I was back smoking crack a short time after that, you know, and did it for another 2 years. Went to a real horrendous, pitiful, and incomprehensible demoralizing bottom, because I never connected with the other substances. And I like to say to any newcomer here tonight who likes red wine with red meat or white wine with fish, lose that idea. I was drafted into the National Football League, and nothing had changed in my life. I was 21 years old and was given around $100,000. So coming from the poverty that I'd come from, I was a rich man. But I did not know how to live. I was not part of a fellowship like a church. I was not part of this great fellowship to teach me how to live. I did not know how to live. You understand me? And if you don't learn how to live, you never know how to live. That's why I am so grateful for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. In order. Some of us work them steps like it's a damn menu, you know what I'm saying? You see, before I got to these rooms, I did not know how to live. I never had a life. Sure, I had a career. Sure, I played in 3 Super Bowls. Sure, I made a lot of money on television, but I was not happy. I didn't have a relationship with God. I was not a spiritual man. I had nothing. I had money, property, and prestige, but that is no good if you don't have nothing inside. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me something inside. It filled me up with trust and hope and confidence, love. It taught me how to love me, because before I could love me, I couldn't love you. Tom Landry drafted me in the first round. And of course, he thought I was a mistake. You know, I was from a small college. Tom Landry had this computerized system, okay? And in my school, we played a 5-2 sic-em. So it was a little bit of adjustment for me to read computerized defenses rather than just go out and kick ass, you know what I'm saying? It's a little adjustment, you know? You kind of had to show up every day with a book under your arm, you know what I mean? It became a business. I didn't like Tom Landry. You know, and before I talk about him, I want to tell you, he's the finest man I think I've ever known. He was a Christian man, a family man. He was upstanding in his community. And those of you who were at Sonora Bay last year know he wrote me a letter of amends that blew me out of the water. I hate it when people work this program who ain't in it, don't you? How dare them work this program before I get my shot. When I met people who were on this path of spirituality and real life and family and being, in these relationships with women, they love their wives, you know, I thought Fidelity was a speaker system or something, you know what I mean? I had no idea that it had anything to do with standing by your woman, you know. You know, when I was drafted to the National Football League, I did what all athletes do. And I think this is what every athlete does who ain't never had nothing. You know, I got this big check, so I went and bought a brand new car and a stereo system. I didn't have nowhere to park it or plug it up, but that was my first purchases. By the time I reached the National Football League, my drinking and drugging were like, you know, no big deal. I mean, I had probably been, you know, somebody got me a drink once or twice in college. I got drunk once or twice in college. I took a lot of acid and took a lot of speed, but that didn't count. I mean, those kind of things didn't count. I mean, I just didn't drink. In 1975, when I got drafted, we went to the Super Bowl and we played the Pittsburgh Steelers in 1975. I was a rookie. We were America's team. And it was 1976 and we were celebrating the bicentennial of America from 1776 to 1976. And some guy named Calder, a great artist, painted the Jets. And we went to Miami to play the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I got to tell y'all, it was the first time in my life that I started feeling uncomfortable with the success. Feeling uncomfortable around these people. Because people like Roger Staubach and Tom Landry and Bob Brunig and some other people I knew were Christians. They were faithful to their wives. And I used to say to them, I'm serious, I used to say to Roger Staubach, hey man, don't you get it? It's the women, the drugs, the club. Come on. And I thought it was something wrong with them. See, and now I got to realize there was something wrong with me. See, when you're raised in a dysfunctional home by dysfunctional people, you become a dysfunctional child, a dysfunctional adolescent, a dysfunctional adult. And until you change that, that's who you are. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous is such a wonderful thing for me. I like what I've got. I don't need to look around this room and want what you got. I remember being at a lecture about 2 months ago. A friend of mine, Jerry C., sober 37 years, came to speak at one of the little meetings for me down in Austin. And he came in, and it was a low-bottom meeting, and he told his story. Now, he's worth about $20 million, you know, and he's about 70 years old, and he's, you know, he's just, he's a great man. He works on the Council of Alcoholism in Texas. But anyway, when he got through, I thought it was because he said, he told the guys, if you want what I got, you know, you got to be doing this. And so I looked at him. I said, well, Jerry, let me get this straight. If I want what you got, I said, when I'm 70 years old, I'll be short, white, and rich. Is that right? And I use that to say, you got to want what you got at some point in this program, or you just don't drink and go to meetings. Because there is a solution in this program. It's all over this book that I love so much, that changed my life. We were preparing to play the Steelers, and Mike Ditka, who's the head coach of the Chicago Bears, came over to me and said, Thomas, you've been elected captain of the specialty teams for the Super Bowl. And I had a great year. I mean, you know, I was wild. I would run down the field. And, you know, like a blind person, what I used to really love about running is I could feel the wind against my face because God had really blessed me to run. I could run. My legs never failed me. You know, I tell you, God blessed me with some legs. I've never had an injury to my legs. I just could run. And I could run. And so we were playing this Super Bowl, and he said, okay, Thomas, you got to go out in the middle of the field here for the coin toss. And so I got ready for this and walked out there with Roger Staubach and Randy Whitehead and Charlie Waters and Leroy Jordan and all these people. And you know what? I always looked at other people as better than me. It didn't matter what my ego said. It didn't matter how I dressed or what car I drove. I always thought you were better than me. You just didn't know it. I was just glad to be here. I get out in the middle of the field, you know, feeling less than and feeling like I ain't supposed to be there. Almost afraid that somebody's going to come over the intercom and go, hey, 56. Come on. You don't deserve to be here. Get your ass out of here. And I wonder what that is. You know, you walk around with impending doom, kind of a, I don't belong. You know, I'm ashamed. You know, what if they know that I used to smell like urine when I was growing up? What if they know that I was, you know, they used to get beat up by my mom all the time? What if they knew all this? Will they still like me? So what goes on in the dysfunctional mind? I'm standing there. They're about to play the national anthem. The official there has a 200-year-old coin. It says 1776 on it. It's a thick piece of gold. On the back, it's got a head, and on this side, it's got the dates. And he says, we're going to flip this to see who kicks off and receives the Super Bowl 10. And what am I thinking in my little ghetto mind? I want to steal the coin. You just cannot stop dysfunctional thoughts coming to the dysfunctional mind. I watched the official the whole game. See, part of me was a thief. Part of me was a liar. All of me didn't know how to live until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1976, I started to drink a little. I started drinking Tom Collins. And I tell you what I liked about Tom Collins. I liked the cherry and the orange and the umbrella more than any other part of the drink. A bartender told me, he said, I said, well, what can I drink? I really don't drink. Give me, what can I drink? You know, he never said club soda. They assume you got to have something. You know, growing up in America, it seems like I'm not surprised that Alcoholics Anonymous has grown as big as it has grown. I'm not surprised that we are alcoholics and addicts. Because if you think about it, drinking is ordained on us. Drinking is a rite of passage to adulthood. It's a 21-year-old thing to do. It's a prerequisite to adulthood. You know, 10 years ago, they finally figured out that alcoholism was causing family problems and drunk driving and all sorts of things. So they decided we need to inform the American people about know when to say when. So they searched high and low for the proper spokesperson to on television to tell us how to or how not to drink, and they found a dog. I don't know if y'all remember the dog Spuds McKenzie, but he is the official spokesperson of responsible drinking in America. Spuds, the little party animal, knows when to say when. He's a dog. He don't know what to shit, let alone what to drink. But here is our moral spokesperson of how to drink. Oh, yeah, he got three women on his arms. You know, the party animal. When I had three women on my arm, it was a sin. When he does it, it's education. I mean, if you just watch TV commercials, that's why I'm afraid for our children. I mean, our children are inundated. A recent statistic says that by the time our children are 18 years old, they will have seen 100,000 beer or wine cooler commercials. But if you watch those commercials close enough, for instance, the one with Bartles and James, the two old guys. Now, Ed don't even know he's in a commercial. I mean, they've set him up to be the alcoholic already. What's apparent to me in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the reason that we're here today, and the reason that we're the lucky ones, is we did one thing. We stopped drinking. We stopped the bleeding so that some repairs could be made from the inside out, that we could work on ourselves. We were given these 12 steps, but what we had to do, we had to stop drinking. Stop drinking. Stop smoking. Stop shooting dope. Stop. Not slow down, not cut back, not change brands. Stop. Now, I tell this story about the difference between stop and slow down. This guy was driving through this small town, and he comes to a stop sign. And he looks both ways, but he don't stop. He slows down, and he goes through the stop sign. Well, a policeman pulls him over and says, your driver's license, sir. He said, for what? He said, well, you run that stop sign back there. He said, well, come on, officer. You saw me. Be careful. Slow down. Look both ways. He said, well, it's not a slow down sign. It's a stop sign. And he said, well, stop, slow down. What's the damn difference? He said, well, you don't know the difference between stop and slow down? He said, no. He said, well, come out of the car. He pulls him out of the car, grabs him by his collar, pulls out his billy club, and starts hitting him across the head. He said, now, you want me to stop? You want me to slow down? So there clearly is a difference. There's clearly a difference between stop and slow down. You know, I played for the Dallas Cowboys from 1975 to 1979, 5 years. I went to 3 Super Bowls before I was 25 years old. I developed some real bad habits because I just didn't know how to live. I was just talking to somebody about my wife, my first wife. I've been married twice. My first wife married me during my worst days. You know, it was like one of those relationships where sometimes you're with a woman for 5 or 6 years, and by the time you marry them, the relationship is already over. Somebody said, it's kind of like an afterthought or something, you know? But she and I were sitting one night in Dallas, Texas, with 2 Mercedes in the garage, and she had diamonds on, and I had diamonds on, and we had Dom Perignon sitting on ice, and cocaine sitting on a mirror, and I said to her, honey, things are nice now, aren't they? We got it going on. We're living high and large. And I said, baby, I said, tell me, if I lost it all tomorrow, would you still love me? She said, love you? She said, I'll always love you. I'll miss you. So I kind of knew who I married. She was too pretty to let go. But I became an expendable person because of my alcoholism and my behavior. See, my behavior began to surface. And if you're anything like me, boy, I tell you what, please don't judge me by my actions. Please, you know I don't mean to. I mean, I always wanted to be judged on my intentions. I didn't intend to. But see, people always judge me on my actions. And I became Violet Faye. I was abrasive. I was threatening. I was murderous. And I was capable of shooting and killing you. I just know that cocaine and alcohol made everything go away. You know, I didn't have to think. I remember going to meet my father when I was 21 years old, and boy, it was a big deal to go meet your dad when you're 21 years old. But some part of you, when you finally meet him and you get to sit back and reflect on it, you go, where has he been? And why am I all of a sudden important? And that creates, I think, a low-grade depression and shame. Because every time I introduced my father, I had to explain where he'd been, you know. This is my dad. I just met him, you know. I just met him. And this is a true story. You know, sometimes I get to tell my stories and people go, geez. I was playing for the San Francisco 49ers in 1980. I had invited my real father from New York to come out. Let's develop a relationship. So I gave him $2,000 and asked him to get an apartment in Oakland because me and my wife were staying in San Francisco. And of course, I had him set all this up because I had plans for this other apartment. So he goes and gets an apartment. I bought him a brand new car. And I bought sheets and did all this stuff. Now, I had his father was back in New York dying on his deathbed, and I'd given him one of my Super Bowl rings. And I didn't give it to him. I just said, here, won't you wear this for a while? And boy, he's in the hospital with a Super Bowl ring on, and just, he's dying, you know, but he just really, his last days with my grandson is Thomas Henderson. And Bill Walsh came on the field one day. I'm practicing, and he said, look, one of those Tom Landry phone calls, he said, there's a guy on the phone in here. You got a message. I think you should go take care of it. I go in and pick up the phone, call this phone number, and the guy says, I just want you to know that your father just pawned your Super Bowl ring. So thanks, Dad. And so as I tried to find him and create this relationship, things like this were happening, you know, and that don't feel good. And so what do you do with these feelings when you don't know what to do with these feelings? What do you do with feelings if you don't even know you got feelings? You drink. You smoke. There's no way to process it. There's no steps for you if you're not in this program. There's no way to vent this, to let this go. There's no process for a dysfunctional man, woman, boy or girl. There's no process. I feel sorry for people who are not in this program. I visit with them all the time. Tom Landry fired me in the Monday before Thanksgiving, 1979, because I was a disruptive influence, not only to the Dallas Cowboys, but to the city of Dallas. I was out of control. I was insane. I got picked up by the 49ers. But they don't take kindly to you coming to work and putting on your uniform, and after you've been out for 5 days and laying on the field, you know, yawning and going to sleep. That's not part of practice. So they let me go. Then I went to treatment, got out of treatment, not sober. And then I got traded to the Miami Dolphins. You know, it's a hell of a thing to be a cocaine addict and be traded to Miami. It's just not a good geographic. You know what I mean? You really want to go to North Dakota or something, you know? I broke my neck in August 1981, I snapped the cervical vertebrae number one in my head, in my neck, on the field, in the Orange Bowl, playing against the Kansas City Chiefs, and that ended my NFL career. But I had a $175,000 salary to collect over 16 weeks. And I would go to the mailbox every Tuesday and pick up this check for $14,000 or so dollars. And I had a gallon of Tanqueray, a lot of tonic, a lot of cocaine, and I tried to kill myself. Within a very short period of time, when the doctors told me I couldn't play football no more, I'm not going to say that what sprung me. I was already full out there into my drug addiction and my but alcoholism came on at the very end. You know, I found myself after losing everything at the liquor store like mom and dad with the bottle, with the paper bag twisted tight and getting in my car. That was 1981, 82. And 83. And I don't have to describe to alcoholics the insanity that goes on with a man who spends $14,000 a week. I don't need to explain that to you. I don't like to get into too many war stories, but when you spend $14,000 a week for 16 weeks and you're doing cocaine and you're drinking and you're calling hookers and you're in cheap motels and you got a gun loaded and you're crazy and you're acting out and you don't know how to live, you don't know where to go, you don't know what to do, and your family don't want you and your team don't want you and the city don't want you, but the police want you. I lived in that terror place, you know. I came to that place where, and I'm feeling it right now, where, you know, you get to that place that I want to quit this, but I don't know how. I missed everything in that treatment program. I was lost. I didn't know about no AA. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that part. Finally, it happened in November 1983. I was in California, and I was charged with sexual misconduct and false imprisonment, possession of narcotics and cocaine and paraphernalia. And now all of you knew, and now it was time to check out. See, it's time to die.
See, because that place in the big book where it talks about that pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing place, I was there. They took snapshots of me there. I wanted to die. I didn't know how to do that. I had a brother who committed suicide because he couldn't stop smoking crack. That's when I met Chuck Denmark. Chuck D. You ain't supposed to. I went to a care unit in Orange, California, and I went there because I was in trouble. That's the amazing thing about an alcoholic or anybody who's in crisis, will do anything to get out of trouble. We will sign up for the damnedest things when we're in trouble. Just give me some get out of trouble. So I went into treatment because I wanted out of that trouble, but I wanted all that stuff out of my head. See, that's where my danger was. I wanted it out of my head. But see, the world knew, and every newspaper in the world carried my story, and I was, you know, the only thing for me to do was just put a gun in my mouth and blow the back of my head out. Dr. Joe Persh told me, he said, Thomas, he said, suicide is a permanent solution for a temporary problem. I said, whatever that means. I checked into the care unit in Orange, California, November about the 4th or 5th, 1983. And all I remember is going through detox and taking Valium. I showed up there. You know, I tell you what my last drunk was. My last drunk was getting out of jail, posting out of jail, buying a case of Coors beer, and drinking all of them as I smoked cocaine. And I remember, this was the insanity of my alcoholism. This is what I remember about my alcoholism. Throughout the night, I would put cigarettes out in cans of beer. By morning, I was out of beer. And I had this thing in my mind that I could actually drink the beer without tasting the nicotine. So I would drink 6 or 7 half cans of beer with a cigarette in it. And I, you know, whenever I think about, am I an alcoholic? I would also have 151 rum. By the way, people, it burns. To light my swath that I lit my cocaine with. And by the end of the night, you know, that looked pretty dirty and dingy, you know, and there's about that much left in the bottle. And I would drink that. So I qualify to be here. Chuck D. took me to a meeting. He came into this hospital. He walked in and said, my name is Chuck Denmark, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm taking you to a meeting. And, you know, and part of me wanted to say, "Who? I ain't going nowhere with you. I don't know you." As if I needed to know somebody, you know. I should have been grateful that people would even speak to me. He took me to a meeting. I don't remember much about the meeting. But I do remember him telling me that I could change my life. I remember him telling me, I know you're in a lot of trouble. So I know your head is full of you don't want to live no more and all that. Doctor told me, he said, but I'll tell you what, Thomas, he told me a story. You know, and it had to be a miracle because I never listened to white people for nothing, see? It had to be the time for me to get this. It had to be the moment. I wasn't ready for this until I was ready for this. And that night I was ready. I just listened and he said, you know, you got to get a sponsor. And I was riding over in the passenger seat and I said, well, will you be my sponsor? He said, sure, I'll be your sponsor. And that's how this new life I got started, in a car riding down the Santa Ana Freeway in Orange County. With nothing, with no hope, no trust, no faith, no spirituality. All I had was a sponsor. And all I had was a program. That's all I had. I have this thing that if you got somewhere else to go when you come to this room, that you'll probably go there. See, I have nowhere else to go. I'm at home in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the only thing I've been able to count on all my damn life. I've never been able to count on anybody, any place, ever. See, AA is that beacon, that light, that it's always there. You know, no matter where I go, it's there. I've been to Germany. You know, I spoke to some 2,000 Germans. I opened up with "Ich bin ein großer Schwarzer Amerikaner." Translated, that means I'm a big black American and I'm sober. Amazing. I can speak German, but I can't speak Spanish. When I talk to a newcomer or share my story with somebody, you know, in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's real important. It says there that we got to share what has been our experience. And when I came to the rooms, I had nowhere else to go. And in Orange County, California, I went to 3 meetings a day for 7 months or 8 months. That's all I had to do. I had a good friend of mine in Texas who said, if you just do that, I'll send you a couple of $100 a month. I got me a car, and my sponsor put me, he went and bought me, went down to the Newport Club, and he went and bought me a bumper sticker, and it said, "My other car is up my nose." And I had a $200 car that I was making payments on. And I was behind in my payments. But that was okay because I was on a mission, a grateful mission from God. So I hung around the rooms for 7 months and then finally that case came before a judge and I got 2 years in the penitentiary. And in all honesty, I got to tell y'all, I went there with a program. I went there with friends and support. People bought up panels. People wrote me every day. I got 72 big books mailed to me, 92 12 and 12s, 100 a day at a time. And people just loved me and said, "Thomas, if you'll stay sober, you'll stay free. If you'll stay sober, your life will change. And if you want a life, work those steps. Don't be afraid of therapy and counseling and aftercare. Don't be afraid to acknowledge your childhood. Don't be afraid to acknowledge any sort of abuse. Be honest. Be forthcoming. Tell it like it really is." Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a life. I spent the 2 years and 4 months in the state of California penitentiary and got out to celebrate my 3-year anniversary at Hogue Hospital in Newport Beach. And I got married while I was in the penitentiary. I think it was because of the conjugal visit, but we stayed married 5 years. She was in the program. And I decided sometime when I was locked up that, you know what, this story needs to be told. I got to tell this story. So I wrote a book called Out of Control, appropriately titled. I came out and I decided I need to tell as many people about this as I can, to use my celebrity to go around and talk about this. But one of the things you got to do when you're a celebrity in this thing, you got to stay sober. You know, and I'm proud today that I'm sober, and the forecast looks good. I like my life. I like what I've got. That's not real incestuous. That's not selfish. I like what I got today. I prayed last year for a woman in my life, and my 13-year-old daughter moved in September. I remember my daughter 5 years ago, when I was struggling as a public speaker. I was laying on my couch in Orange County, California, smoking a cigarette, drinking coffee, watching the news. And she wanted to go to Disneyland or somewhere, and she came downstairs, and I'm laying on the couch smoking a cigarette, watching television, and with shorts on and shoes and socks, and looking at the television, smoking and talking on the phone. She said, "Daddy, I want to go out. Let's go out and play. Let's go do something." She was 9 years old. I said, "Look, hold on. Can't you see I'm busy? Can't you see I'm working? Now get back upstairs and we'll go somewhere later on, okay?" "Okay." So she went back upstairs. I got back on the phone. I was watching television, smoking, and talking on the phone. She came back down. She said, "Dad." I go, "Just a minute." "Yes." She said, "What time do you get off?" With her little sarcastic ass. My wife and I divorced in 1989, and I moved back to Texas. My wife and I had a disagreement. I wanted children and wanted to move to Texas, and she didn't want to do either. So we decided to get a divorce. And I moved to Texas. I can't tell you why. You know, I can't say it was some kind of spiritual thing, but something moved me to go home, because the only thing I remember about my hometown was the pain of my mother. So I moved back to Austin, April of 1990, to my mother, who was still drinking heavily, overweight, and just pure alcoholic. And I got home, and I thought I'd made a mistake. And people here, some of you know that in April last year at Sonora Bay, I told you I was going to a family week. Well, Violet Faye, Miss Shoot 'em Up Annie Oakley, went to treatment at Sierra Tucson, and she's been sober now for 9 months. Still dangerous, but funny story. My stepfather, they were in a group setting, and I got my mother's permission to tell this story. They were in a group setting, and he drinks and she drinks, and I'm in the room, and my sister's here, and my niece is here, and a couple of my nephews are in the room. And the counselor said, LC, his name is LC, a very dark man. LC, so when you and Violet are outside drinking under the tree, they talked about the tree and playing dominoes in the yard. And the therapist says, "Do you ever hit her?" And LC said, in the best language he knew how to muster, he said, "No, sir. She done shot several men." So. And you know those counselors, they get that counselor knot. So hitting her is not an option. I had talked to Chris, and I asked Chris to lead this meeting tonight because, you know, when Chris talks about being 3.5 years sober and hadn't worked the steps, you know, you kind of understand. And one of the things I think that hurts sometimes in our program, as wonderful as it is somebody says, just don't drink and go to meetings, and people don't have any solutions in their life. And some of us need to work through some stuff. And if we do, we're lucky. I have a couple of things I wanted to share that this are right in here. It says, talking about alcoholism, it engulfs all whose lives touch and suffer. This is on page 18. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employees, and this line, warped lives of blameless children. You know, and I was one of those children. So I need, you know, and I think Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, I think they were all in line with do whatever you need to do.